For June the 20th, 2014, we talk about the Torment Tides of Numenera delay, Watch Dogs, and we ask you about choice in games. Welcome to the 66th level. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
I'm David Mysmith.
I'm Ben Merkel.
And you're listening to The Level, a podcast for people who love video games. Gosh darn it. Guys, I'm probably going to end up taking this to work so it doesn't affect too many lives, but I just wanted to display my new acquisition courtesy of my brother who brought it down this weekend. Let me give you a little sampling of this.
Cowbell.
Good. Hey, gold star, Dennis.
Yes. Yes.
Why? I knew I was channeling Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
So, the force is strong with this one.
He hands me a package. It's wrapped up in Kroger bags, and it's a cowbell. I don't know where he got it, and it's going in the collection.
Nice.
And I think this may
the
be
collection of cowbells
of miscellaneous bells. So I bought the one bell. You know, this one over here, you know, and I suppose since I want to be John Roderick, you know, it might as well collect bells as well as anything. Right. And so
are you a bell snob?
No, I don't think I'm a bell snob. I think in order for this to be a legit collection, what has to happen is I don't buy any of them. If I buy any myself, they have to come from thrift stores or they have to be used. Right. So it has to be an interesting bell that I find in a non-Amazon kind of place or online kind of place. Or additionally, if somebody gives me a bell, I will accept the bell and it will go into the collection.
Nice. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
I just like the idea.
Like you at the Battle of the Ball.
Yeah.
I like the idea that Chris Ross needed to make a cow disappear. You were like the perfect front to get rid of the bell.
are you implying that I was accessory to bovine subterfuge?
Yeah, you know about Ohio's cow mafia, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the entire Southeast Ohio, like it's they call it the Huntington Wheeling Ironton triangle.
Yeah,
it's the cow corridor.
You could say they're movers and shakers.
God, no, you couldn't.
Well, you could, but you'd be awful.
Yes, yes, I am.
Oh, so what do we have in store for you today? Well, we're going to talk about video games. Obvs. Did I say it's a podcast for people who love video games? I think I did. I was so excited to talk about my new fucking bell. So
a podcast for people who love bells.
Bing. Yeah. So let's see here. We're looking at some news. We're looking at the multiplayer question about choice and such, leading up to a big thing coming up next week. And
you make that sound so philosophical. Like, we'll discuss the nature of choice.
Free will. You know, is there some kind of Protestant predetermination? You know, is this some kind of Hobbesian or Calvinist?
Calvin.
A Calvin or Hobbesist.
Oh, did you good. Know that's actually who Calvin Hobbes is named after?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
it was kind of a Freudian slip that was informed by knowledge that I had pre-existing. So you can never be sure if it was intentional or not,
or predestined or not.
Mm, yeah, somebody wrote this before. We are all players on a play. We're the music makers, the dreamer of dreams, and then we also round out by talking about the games we've played.
And eventually we get around to video games.
Nailed it.
Hey guys, it's time for the brief where we talk about games or things that are happening in the world of games. Does anybody have a story? Okay, cool. I'll go with the story.
Yeah, I was gonna say I do, but I'll go last.
Yes, you go last because you have an announcement to make. Yeah. So my story has to do with the Torment, the Tides of Numenera. The kickstarted RPG that is the spiritual successor / non-licensed spinoff of the Planescape Torment game.
Really hoping for Numa Numa Kid.
Man, no, sorry. Gonna have to put you in the meme box. Yeah, gonna have to put you in the meme box. Yeah. No. So that was kickstarted back in, I think, 2013, 2012, something like that. I backed it. I should have gotten this update, but I didn't. So initially it was targeted for Q4 of this year, December of 2014, and they just announced that it's going to be pushed back by one full year. So it is now targeted for Q4 of 2015. Yes. So looking at this here, basically the notion is that with Wasteland 2 kind of going into early access and seeing how that went, they kind of figured out, yeah, we need to, you know, reestimate what this stuff is going to take. So basically this is them saying, yeah, but like, what's it going to take to get a finished product out there? So
I'm sorry, what happened with Wasteland 2? I missed that one.
Oh, just that, you know, they put it out as early access, you know, kind of as part of its funding. So they did a Kickstarter, got it into a functional place, and then continued the crowdfunding through early access. You know, basically the funded alpha beta, access kind of stuff. So Wasteland 2 is going to launch in full in August. And I think it's just a matter of the studio taking on too many things at once.
So it's the same studio.
Yeah. For the last while, we've been in what I would call limited production mode, said the project lead. During this phase, the emphasis has been on proving out our design and pipelines, i.e. how exactly we get anything from being an idea to being fully implemented in the game. This is typical for pre-production, but the distinction I'd make is that we've been creating actual game content, which is unusual in the industry. So it kind of sounds like the fire the cannon indoors and started conflating pre-production and actual production, which is which is bad news in terms of workflow.
Yeah, so, it's going to be a lot of backtracking.
A little bit, yeah. Especially, I mean, they have a lot of assets out, like, and it's stuff that doesn't look like it's concept art, which is bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I don't know. I mean, I'm fine. Like, this is, you just as somebody who gave them, I don't know, something like $50. I forget what I backed at. As an investor in this venture, I don't feel too bad about them pushing it back. Because when you throw something at a Kickstarter, you just kind of have to assume that it's never going to exist.
Yeah, I was going to say, has any Kickstarter ever accurately forecasted what it was going to take to get the game out on time?
FTL did a really good job of that. Republic skipped. Yeah, they slipped a lot. What's the other one? You know, I forget. Those are kind of the big ones. But FTL kind of is the canonical success story for Kickstarter, for crowdfunded gaming like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, what do you guys think? I mean, I know that none of you have backed anything, have you? Well, I mean, aside from, you know, the WAF one.
But. Yeah, I want to say I backed one other Kickstarter, but I can't remember what it was.
Yeah.
So. I know. Kickstarter annoys me because I only ever find projects I want to back after the Kickstarter is over. It sort of annoys me that they don't have, like, some sort of post-Kickstarter system where you... I mean, presumably the company would still like to have money.
Yeah. A lot of places that I've seen, you know, like, specifically the high-profile ones, the highest profile being Star Citizen, have actually, you know, had basically tail funding on their thing. So it's like, here's the bare minimum that we need to make this an actual thing, and then continuing their crowdfunding off-site. So either having a donation button or some kind of home-brewed implementation for, you know, basically how to get people to pay for this thing before it exists. But yeah, Star Citizen, you know, has made $40 million doing that. So
yeah. I guess I tend to do more early you know, Soylent Greenlight early access stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's kind of like kickstarting things.
A little bit, yeah.
Kickstarting things, that's like from the future, predestined kickstarting?
Maybe, yeah. I think the difference is you actually have to have something to show on Greenlight. Like, it kind of actually has to be a game before it happens, or, you know, a very early. So there's like Greenlight, there's early access.
I wonder how many things you could logically chain together, like have a Kickstarter to get your game to green light, to get it to X, to get it to Y.
Patreon.
Yes, to Patreon. Okay, so for every month that I say that I'm developing this game.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know.
Kickstarter has evolved.
I would say Kickstarter to green light seems almost standard now.
Yeah. And that's what Among the Sleep did.
Yeah. And that's cool. I mean, it's nice that there's a pathway for smaller games that need funding to get made.
Yeah. I don't, I'm comfortable with that. I'm comfortable with the crowd being the bottleneck as opposed to, you know, the fat cats up in Washington, man. Yeah.
Or there's greedy video game developers.
Oh, they're all in cahoots. They're all part of the Trilateral Commission. Yeah. Ben, you got a story?
I do not. Because I did not know there was a podcast until 5 minutes before the podcast.
We gotta figure out what's up with your phone. We really do.
Like, I got the message yesterday. I just didn't download it until today. Oh, so for some reason, yeah, whatever.
Okay, yeah. I'm not even going to go there.
Yeah.
Basically, what happened is my whole half of the city shut down yesterday, and I sent out a message to everybody in regards to a planning thing saying, yeah, I'm not going to be able to really respond to much because I'm trying to conserve charge in case my house burns down. And so that's the message Ben got, and he had no idea. So I'm covering for Alvach for you, Ben.
All right.
Yeah, cool. Cutting you some slack. David, how about you?
I've sort of got something.
Okay.
I've decided, since I never actually have video game news, I have found two kind of small articles that relate to some of the hosts' obsessions that I thought I'd kick off. So the first one is scientists have discovered why monstrously large insects and spiders don't exist. Apparently they did an experiment with fruit flies where they found that fruit flies have two genes that make them really freaking huge. One controls how fast they grow, mm-hmm. and the other controls how long they grew. How long in terms of time, not like stretch fruit flies.
Yeah.
But
we call those worms.
Right.
Fruit worms.
But they found that upping one inhibited the other, so it's not possible to make them giant and eating Tokyo. I feel like the real take home here is that every so often I hear Bill Nye or someone be like, hey, why doesn't anyone trust science? And I feel like here's the answer right here, because basically what this article says is it's impossible to create giant bug monsters. We tried.
Yeah. And that's just the research that they're willing to show you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at least we know they're not going to be giant bugs. See, I thought that the giants could never roam the earth because of the square cube rule.
Yeah, I think that's also the case where so it's like your what is it, like your
so your mass or your volume grows at an order of magnitude faster, I think actually by an order of magnitude. So your volume goes up by cubes as opposed to kind of your footprint or your height or any like one dimension of you going up as it goes. So if you double in height and everything else goes up proportionally, your mass is going to go up by 8, right? And so
right.
And so something really big can't support itself on legs because Godzilla's ankles would snap and he would just kind of like
it ends up like the whole like Barbie doll dimensions thing.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear something really creepy?
Sure.
This is from Cosmos, but apparently at a previous point in Earth, when there was much more oxygen in the atmosphere, bugs could grow a lot larger than they were because they could absorb the oxygen over more parts of their body.
Yeah.
And so, centipedes used to be the size of crocodiles.
Awesome.
And that's exactly why I buy a gas guzzler car.
Gotta keep that shit tamped down.
Terrifying. Yeah.
Sure. Wait a second, you drive a Fiat.
Not the point. It was a joke.
He lets it idle overnight, though, so he's doing his part. Yeah.
And for the new listener going, what the hell are they talking about? We have discussed spiders, particularly giant spiders, in video games on several different occasions.
Yes,
and my extreme fear of them.
Yeah. Okay, so this is your obsession. Okay, cool.
Yes. I also have Cole's obsession.
Oh boy, I can't wait to hear this.
Yes. So I think
I have so many.
You guys have probably seen this. A computer for the first time has passed the Turing test.
Oh yeah.
Which is the general test for I guess maybe for determining like a computer is intelligent or whatever.
Yeah, it's so, like can a computer fool somebody into thinking that it is a human?
Right, right. So now in the very near future, Core will be able to make
We'll be able to live out Blade Runner. So what you're saying
yes,
is I need to really step up my drinking. Like I'm kind of operating at a junior varsity level, but in order to be like a real, you know, like Deckard, I've got to be like JV or, you know, maybe like a first division college.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Cool. Yeah.
Exactly. Work
Roy,
on your
Roy work Batty, on your... here I come.
Yeah, so soon Cole will be able to Blade Runner all the time. But I feel like, am I the only one, though, that has at some point been playing like a multiplayer game and everyone except the bots drops and you don't notice? I feel like video games have passed the Turing test a long time ago.
I think that's mostly because of the names. So, like, the developers have started getting smart about, like, okay, this guy's going to be Bong Lord, this guy's going to be Super Saiyan Goku Sephiroth, you know, on and on down the line. There's a Markov chain that explicitly generates douchebags. douchebag names. So,
oh,
you know, like, you know, like, oh, gosh, you just got capped by Fuckbulb. Like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Like,
sounds
I
about
wonder
right.
If I could get an article published on the douchebag Markov chain. Yeah. In Markov. Like, maybe not Nature,
my head
but maybe
hurts.
One of the smaller journals.
I love the idea of us doing this physically hurting Ben. It's like the less sense we make, it's like an inverse.
Wait.
No, I don't like that I hurt you.
Yeah. No,
you
know?
I don't like that I hurt you, I just like that you hurt. It's a very fine distinction. No. So here's the thing that I think is bullshit about the Turing test. You know, Turing got a raw deal. So I don't want to taint his legacy too much, especially after it has so recently been, you know, restored. Like they actually, you know, gave him a Britain gave him a posthumous pardon for committing the unthinkable federal crime of homosexuality. So good on you guys. It only took you what 70 years.
Yeah.
But no, the thing about the Turing test is what? Like, you only have to convince a panel of 30% of a panel of judges that you're human in order to pass this.
Right.
So 30% seems kind of low. Like, I would think that I would peg that as so 30. This one did 33%, so a full one third. And I, you know, who knows? These guys may have been paid to take a fall, right?
Well, yeah. there's been
now, like
now,
Deep Blue.
The funny thing is that the computer was smart enough to find them and pay them to take a fall.
Oh gosh, we're through the looking glass here, people.
Oh yeah, the other things that I find funny with it is one that not only it convinced them that it was a 13-year-old. I feel like that's a significantly lower bar.
Oh, so all I had to do was just say dirt bikes over and over again.
Exactly. And also, apparently it's fairly common for human beings to fail the Turing test. Because, like, you know, they have the human controls where, like, a certain number of the people they're going with are, you know, actually yeah. humans. And it's fairly common for them to think the humans are the computers.
Yeah. I mean, quote unquote human, quote unquote beings. So do we know? Did they Chinese room this? Like what was it being done through a chat program? Was a smarter child? Like what was the like what were the particulars? Because I just saw the headline and I knew we were fucked, and I didn't look into it any closer.
Sure. It looks like did I link? Pull up the second link I sent. And the very first image, there's like. A terrifying image of the bad guy from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
He's like, you're asking him questions, and he apparently replies back to you.
Okay. Yeah, so it is smarter child. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Huh.
But, but the important detail is that he's supposed to be Ukrainian and he's supposed to be a teenager, which can excuse poor English sentences. Mm-hmm. So It's like the Chinese room test with an actual Chinese person.
He's Ukrainian. He's 13 and he's a fan of Deadpool. So any kind of random string of phrases out of his mouth is considered acceptable.
God, don't even get me started on Deadpool. Don't like
Hamster Sawmeister.
God damn it, Dennis. This was supposed to be a Deadpool free zone. We discuss this before I hit record every week. You know the rules.
More seriously, I feel like kind of the flaw in this is it strikes me that the point of the Turing test is like if we have a generally computer that, you know, computer program that, you know, kind of acts like it's intelligent, the Turing test is how we, you know, how we check.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I feel like this is more like a test of like, can I make a computer program that fools someone into the, you know, it's not an intelligent computer program. It's a Turing test passing computer program.
Yeah. Its goal is to pass the Turing test. It's not a side effect of its intelligence. Yeah.
The ultimate example of teaching to the test.
Well, I mean, the ultimate example of teaching to the test would be Watson, but.
Thank you, Common Core Turing test.
Oh, man, this new math is crazy, you guys. These new teachers should just be, what are they doing to our kids? Every article on Facebook, stop talking about Common Core just because they're teaching stuff differently than you learned it.
Yeah. Everything is different and scary.
Music. I don't understand it. It sounds like modems having sex. Back in my day, we dialed into the internet. But now our phones are the internet. I have no idea what it is. That's full circle. Give me. Oh, God.
I went back to Indiana University to meet up with some old friends over the weekend. And we were laughing at all like the new fashions that are going around. So like super short pants or short shorts are coming back for boys.
Yeah.
And also like horrible. Everyone wears like, you know, jackets to dive bars, like, you know, suit jackets. Yeah. And so we're laughing at this and it's really amusing just to kind of sit there and people watch. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we're walking out. I'm like, guys, how long until this stops being funny and starts being scary?
Well, I mean, if teenagers don't scare you, then you've got one of those what was that villain from that terrible James Bond movie where he couldn't feel any pain?
Yeah.
Die Another Day. Or
The World Is Not Enough.
The World's Not Enough.
I haven't gotten to that one yet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I mean, just like, if you're not scared of teenagers, something's really wrong with you. Yeah. Yeah.
Spoiler alert, it's a bad movie.
Spoiler alert, most of them are. And that's what
Yeah. It's just
Screw
a myth.
That. James Bond is always awesome.
Sean Connery is always awesome.
Exactly. You make a great point, Dennis. I think you know, it is kind of funny to laugh, but then you realize, yeah, we're gonna be our dads. Something, God, I feel like I'm going a mile a minute tonight. I'm so sorry. I've got some kind of imbalance happening. I watched Days of Future Past, and I was digging it when they went back to the past. Oh, let me put this line out. If anybody knows where I can get the glasses that Hank wore in Days of Future Past, the Beast with the clear bottoms of the rims, let me know. Get in touch with me. I want to have something like that. So, but I was looking at the the fashion. I was like, yeah, I can get on board with this. And I realized, oh, that's just like how normal people dress. So it's supposed to be 70s, but it's just like, you know, people dressing in the 70s in like t-shirts and jackets and jeans and stuff.
Not characterized.
Yeah.
Caricaturized.
Uh-huh. It's like, okay. Like this is just normal clothing. And like that has aged so much better than even, you know, clothing from the, you know, from like the early 90s or even, you know, the 2000s when we kind of grew up. You know, you don't see people mm-hmm. walking around in hoodies with lots of, you know, chains on their jeans. Like, you know, like yeah, when we were
actually,
young.
Yes, I do. But...
Well, I mean, that's your cross to bear.
Stop looking in the mirror, well, David.
I feel like part of it, there's like the uncanny valley of like classic clothing, if that makes sense.
Like,
there's a certain degree of like clothing that is always going to be fashionable. You know, like jeans, khakis, You know, like button-ups, t-shirts, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I feel like there's the uncanny valley of, like, dressing that way but not crossing the line to where you're, like, crossover into, like, ultra-hipster
territory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know quite. I don't know that I'm grasping the nuance of it. All I can think of is the side effect of my sartorial decisions or my sartorial dogma is that I'm building up a mythos where if I need to disappear, like I don't need to like dye my hair and get a new name or, you know, get like reconstructive surgery or wear lots of masks. I just need to put on like a red t-shirt and blend into a crowd. like if I put on a red t-shirt and some like dolphin shorts, like goodbye, Cole. Hello.
Yeah.
You know, hello, Armin Tamzarian or whatever, you know?
See, generally, if I'm trying to like escape from danger, I avoid red shirts.
Well, yeah. Huh. You guys want to do the multiplayer?
Well, hold on a second.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Don't we have something to tell the nice people?
I think we do. I'm sorry. we got so sidetracked that I quickly tried to derail us, but I overshot. So.
Yeah. All right. As penance for that wild tangent, what is this section called? Not the grind.
That's brief. Yeah.
Jesus Christ. All right. So my brief is actually an announcement, not on the magnitude of my last announcement. but we talked about it a long time ago, but we are going to do a BioShock Infinite bonus level and do an entire episode dedicated to that video game. And then we'll probably also have throwbacks to the original BioShock and a little bit on the DLC as well. But yeah, we're going to dedicate an entire episode to that. And the great part is that for a brief interview at the start, we are going to have the senior producer of BioShock Infinite, his name is Adrian Murphy, join us for an interview. So what I'd love to invite everyone to do is write in questions for Adrian. Mm-hmm. And anything that you want to know about the game, about the that you know went into the production of the game and all that stuff. Send us your questions. We'll kind of take the ones and try to find the themes and based on what you kind of asked for and then, you know, what we're able to ask, we'd love to have your input on what you'd like this interview to look like.
Yeah. So it'll be a similar deal to our Spec Ops episode when we had Yorg on. You know, in terms of how that'll be structured, me being, I'll have to be the bad guy, you guys writing in, we try and read most, every question that comes in, for our regular episodes, we're gonna have to vet those a little bit. So not everyone's going to get in, but we're going to try and represent what you guys would like to know as best as possible.
Yeah. Well said. So he'll be joining us for the first, 30 minutes or so. And again, would love your thoughts on what we should ask him. And then we'll also kind of be spending the rest of the episode kind of going through it a little bit like a WAF treatment. I don't know, if we'll follow their book exactly, but,
nowhere near as granular.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, we'll give kind of the level treatment, to a book club. Yeah. So yeah, BioShock Infinite, if you have thoughts on that, if you have questions for Adrian Murphy, the senior producer, write them in.
Mm-hmm. You can do that at duckfeed.tv/contact.
Yeah,
oh, we're good, on good our Facebook page.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Either or.
Or on Twitter.
You just want to end the episode, don't you? We do the circle and call it I'm on to your games, Money Smith.
I'm completely innocent, but yes.
Multiplayer.
It's time for the multiplayer where we ask you things and stuff. Dennis, can you share with the nice people the question that you asked them?
Yeah, so I asked, lots of games offer choice and multiple ways to play, but often it's just window dressing. So what games offer the most varied experiences with different decisions and play styles? So, you know, everyone talks about how the world will change based on the decisions you make. And so where is it not just a new coat of paint? Where is it actually something significantly different or worth noting?
Yeah, and I'll get us started with Murph, who says, I remember being blown away by the multiple ends of Chrono Trigger and the way the game eventually opened up. This seems so artificial now, where the choice was really just when you fought the last boss. Mechanically, Infamous 2 comes to mind, with vastly different powers that are not all available in one playthrough, a choice that a lot of games aren't brave enough to make. Yeah, that's a pretty important thing, because like a lot of developers, I get the sense, you know, just from the way that things are structured like that, don't want to, you know, hide their light under a bushel.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So the idea of saying like, okay, you know, you have a 50% chance of not seeing this thing that I made. Like they want to make it everything available to you. So that actually is a pretty intense choice for the Infamous devs to make.
Yeah, although I must say that their choice system in terms of like morality, and that's specifically talking about morality systems, is really, really funny, because there literally one of the choices that you make is, hey, there's a bomb strapped to this building. I could disarm it, or I could just walk away. It's like, what? Why? Why would you walk? Give me, like, there's no motivation to walk away. You just could if you wanted to.
To actually step in here, because Infamous is actually my answer.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
I've only played the original Infamous, you know, vanilla Infamous, but for me, it actually, the more choices or choices in general that were really relevant to me were not the actual more choices, because as Dennis pointed out, they were kind of dumb, but it was choosing not to just, you know, you'd often be in combat where there'd be a lot of civilians going around, and having to, like, pull my punches and, you know, not just bust out my most powerful moves so that I didn't kill everyone, I thought, it really, to me, felt a lot more legitimately like I was a superhero, because I had to, like, make those decisions of, like, how do I control this power? Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And it's a shame that the morality system did not necessarily reward those kinds of actions as much as it did the big, dumb, you know, binary ones.
Yeah.
Right.
But absolutely, that is, that, you know, if you put yourself under those constraints, it makes the game much more difficult and much more interesting. It's like when you get into GTA 5 or GTA 4, whatever GTA game you're playing, and you're like, I'm going to follow the traffic rules for the first 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Well, that's everyone does it. You have to admit it. But
that's rolled into Watch Dogs, though. Like the notion of how many civilians you kill, or even just how, you know, how often do you resort to deadly force as opposed to using the tools that are given to you, affects your reputation score. So it is, you know, it is a Fallout-esque karma meter, and I'm not quite sure what it affects just yet, but people react right away to your reputation as you're walking through the streets. So even if it is, you know, superficial, that is still a good you know, incentive to make it the kind of game you want it to be.
It's actually a twist ending, M. Night Shyamalan style. You die at the end of the game, and in the next game, it's literally a karma meter, and it determines what you reincarnate as in Watch Dogs 2.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're real bad, it's just a remake of that PS1 game, Mr. Mosquito.
Oh, man, I haven't thought about that game in a long time.
I'm surprised you even knew what that game is.
I think it was also on computer, and there was a version of it at our library, of all things. They had, like, Mr. Mosquito, and that was it.
I just know they reviewed it on Toonami, so that was my childhood.
That's funny. Yeah. So I like that. Let's see here. Ben, what's Sean say?
Sean says, even though I'm WoW free for 1 year, I think I get an achievement for that, don't I? You better go back on WoW and figure that out.
You'll get one free month for you and your friend.
There was many different things that you could do in the game to keep you mired, strike that, entertained. There was a single player content, which involved leveling through dozens of zones, which often two different storylines for the factions involved. There was the group content, which I will lump both five-man and raid dungeons together. They had different PvP, either arena style or large group v group combat in a variety of environments. They also had an array of daily quests you could do at level cap, which varied from vehicle bombing runs to your generic gather X or kill 10 rat style. I was also making challenges for myself, seeing how much I could push multi-tune content by going into progressively harder old-school raid content solo. Do I miss it? Nah. I get more of my time with my wife now. Wink, wink.
Thanks for that image.
Yeah, okay, cool. Thanks, Sean. I'm just picturing his little Kingdom of Loathing avatar just getting down. Yeah.
What is that it's holding? We don't know.
You gotta club that seal.
Oh my god.
I mean, that's what they do in the game. It's a seal clubber, okay?
No, I know. I just using that as a euphemism for sex is a new take on it. Wouldn't it be more club that beaver? I don't know.
Oh. Yeah. You,
sorry.
It's a fine line, as we're demonstrating.
As we're demonstrating by jumping over it.
Multiple times, even.
Yeah.
Now, I feel like that's actually something that World of Warcraft kind of doesn't get enough credit for, because, you know, when it launched, in a lot of ways, it was very much like we took a very standard MMO format and just made it good, and it was much more like, you know, our whole thing is polished. Whereas over time, it definitely did innovate, but I feel like because it didn't lead with as much of the different innovation, it doesn't get as much credit for it.
It was definitely a trickle, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Like,
but I mean, yeah, like, well, especially, like, I would say it seemed to me like their third and fourth, you know, after their third expansion was really when they doubled down on it. I know one of my favorites, they added an encounter where you basically, like, raise an army and go after the Loch Ness Monster.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, they definitely, it was an overtime sort of thing, but now it's a much more dynamic game, kind of like Sean points out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is a different notion of choice, but just kind of like, what do I want this game to be? Do I want it to be just a kind of like a Diablo-like, I go through and click on a bunch of stuff and do man shopping by upgrading my gear? Cool, you can solo the entire thing. Or there's this entire breadth that's available to you. Like, it's all games to all people to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Were you going to say something about?
No.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah, I have not played WoW at all, so I have little insight to offer, okay. Unfortunately.
I think my favorite instance I ever saw in World of Warcraft, what in terms of, like, choosing your play style, is World PvP, just, like, you know, killing people in the, you know, on a PvP server in the world. They eventually added the concept of dishonorable kills, which is basically, if you killed, like, any useful NPCs, they dinged you for it. It basically killed off World PvP.
Yeah.
However, I had a friend who simply refused to stop doing World PvP despite the fact that he was now punished for it. So, on the guild page, you could like, check people's PvP stats, and it, you know, you'd look and be like, you know, 0 dishonorable kills, 2 dishonorable kills, 10 dishonorable kills, etc. And then you get to him, it was like 1,000 dishonorable kills.
Hey, anytime there's a number, somebody out there is going to try and make it bigger.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'll do mine here. So I've talked enough about Alpha Protocol, and Dennis, you made that the image for this post. So you know, that's it's as good of an example of as any. So I'm going to try and do like a non-standard one and do something that arguably could be considered to not be a game, but it's still a game where kind of the choice is built into the narrative in a very functional way, which is Virtue's Last Reward.
Oh snap, that's a great answer.
Yeah, so it's a visual novel, and there are, you know, some, you know, puzzles and stuff that you're going to solve in that, and you know, the your performance in the puzzles kind of determines how much of the extra narrative you get, but you know, you're going through and you're watching anime heads talk as people blow up, and you're prompted to make choices at different points, and you're led down these paths, and actually exposes a flowchart to you, which is something that you know, what is it, 999 didn't really do. Mm-hmm. And you know, a notion of once you reach the terminus of one of these, this is a minor spoiler, but once you reach the terminus, you can restart at different branching points and see what happened in the others, with the idea being like you have to do all of them and see what the possibilities for these choices are in order to see the, you know, in order to see the full story. So the idea of like, okay, like what kind of conclusion are my natural things going to, you know, take me through, and then as I see and expose everything that happens on these different paths, like what does the narrative look like? It's more of like a puzzle, or, you know, it could possibly be considered just a very well put together choose your own adventure, but the gaminess comes from, you know, actually taking elements from those different paths and combining them in a way that not only makes things make sense, but gives you the true ending, right?
Yeah. What I'll say about it is, where for most games, when you go back through and make different choices, that exposes how little choice you actually have.
Yeah.
In Virtue's Last Reward, and I have to imagine in 999 to some extent, it only gets better as you explore those roads not taken.
Definitely. So it's a reverse Heavy Rain.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
I feel like that's also interesting in that this is the situation where you're going to make all the choices, or at least a lot of the choices, and kind of the idea that, like, actually not making the choice, you know, that's not what's important. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like good game design, because there's no wasted programming time, because all the choices they're making, the player will see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in a way, it's almost the reverse of Infamous, where the entire premise is predicated on, you know, on the drive, and in fact, the necessity of seeing every branch, right?
Yeah. I would say to kind of, for interest's sake, do a different approach. I know one of the stated goals of Fallen London is the exact opposite, which is where a player cannot uncover, make every choice, uncover every element of the backstory, because they explicitly want players to communicate and fill in. The parts of the backstory that they missed.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Huh. Let's hear Dennis. What's David say?
David says, as far as the game feeling different based on build and skill set, I'd have to say Dark Souls, if I'm allowed to talk about that on this show. Secret. Yes. Yeah, spoiler alert. This is really just an additional extra episode for Bonfire.
Sorry. It's appendices.
Appendices, yeah.
Yeah. You have to keep that branding straight, or else everything's going to collapse.
So. Right, yeah. You gotta play it backwards, and you'll see. Anyway, I have finished 3 runs so far of Dark Souls 2. A quality, balanced stats build, a glass cannon mage, all points and caster, and a dual-wielding fist weapon user. And which is funny, because those, the Cestus, is that what they are?
Cestus? Yeah. It's a
Cestus?
Yeah.
Yeah, are like the most popular weapon in slots 1, 2, and 3 in the game's little stat website. Just because everyone's like, I want to do a boxer build. So it's a good choice. Each run had completely different difficulty spikes. Something easy for my caster, Master of Sorcery, Hex, and Miracle, was insanely difficult for the guy whose only verb is punch.
That is the only verb you need.
Punch and walk.
Yeah.
Double Dragon style.
Yeah, for the game that narratively changed based on actions, I have to say Mass Effect Trilogy. By the third game, seeing how different even just a single scene can be, the Genophage arc climax, for example, based on 3 games worth of choices, was staggering. I know the end isn't the most popular, but 95% of those games were excellent. Yeah.
Yes, I kind of want to piggyback on that one. Because I think what I was going to say was, yeah, Mass Effect 3, despite some of its not fun choices towards the end, they did a great job of making really difficult choices throughout the end of the second game and the entire third game, where it was definitely far from clear what was the right choice. And so you had to do a lot of gut thinking. So,
yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of backlash against Mass Effect for, like, oh, your choices don't matter, et cetera. Like the ride matters is what I think really is, you know, important. It's how much you're willing to invest in the weight behind that and the possibility of what's there. Yeah. So I'm with Ben and David on that one.
So would you say that Mass Effect like lends itself to playing through multiple times, or once you get your story, is that kind of your story? Because I know for me, like when I played Heavy Rain for the first time, that I felt like, and my intention was fully to go back and see everything. But then I was like, you know what, that, even though I know I can make different choices and see different things, that feels like my story, the yeah. version I got. And I don't want to sully that by going back and doing things differently.
Yeah, my first playthrough is the canonical one in my mind. I've done Mass Effect 1 and 2, both two times. Okay. Maybe a couple times. Yeah, I've done at least three runs of each.
Nice.
And that is a little bit mitigated by the fact that I actually enjoy the shooting and the combat in Mass Effect 2 a lot. So it's not like a Heavy Rain situation where I'm just trying to see what happens differently. But yeah, I'm totally in your camp that there is kind of the one canonical playthrough. Kind of like I always try it to start a new game in Fallout where I'm the evil guy, but I can never continue doing it.
So that actually leads to my answer, which is perfect, because then we can end with Chris. So my smart ass answer after I thought about this question for a bit would have been Little Big Planet. But then my real answer is Fallout 3. And what amazed me about that game was I played through the first time as you know, pistols and talking. Like can we just name that like duck feed standard for a class build?
Yeah.
Is pistols and talking is like the you're basic.
The gentleman's class.
Yeah. So I did it through that way the first time, and then I didn't finish this run, but I started playing it again as an evil character, like you said, Cole, using heavy weapons and melee and no VATs. So I did the entire game like it was a first-person shooter,
mm-hmm.
Which was just, it was completely different, night and day. And it actually held up. So that was incredible that you can actually play it like a first person shooter and have fun with that. And then the other cool thing was that just by the sheer volume, and I think this is kind of like wow, just by the sheer volume of stuff out there, over the natural course of my second playthrough, I was discovering things and finding whole quest lines and towns that I never stumbled across in my first playthrough.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Fallout 3.
That's a good one. Did you ever play New Vegas?
No, I never got around to it.
Yeah, I think you might like that a lot.
Cool.
I just want, as a side here, pitch two title ideas, Pistols and Talking and the Duck Feed Standard.
Those are both really good. I will add them to kind of a scant list this week. Yeah, Pistols.
Well, after last week, you got to have a bit of a lull.
Yeah. Oh yeah, go ahead, Ben.
I wanted to throw in one more comment. Skyrim, I really liked the variety that they had in the gameplay, where basically whatever you wanted to do, you could advance in that tree and get good at it, and it was pretty fun to do that. So yeah. And that was pretty impressive. Yeah,
most of the trees had something really badass at the end too, so it gave you incentive to work toward it.
Yeah, if you dagger people, eventually you do times 15 damage.
Yeah.
If you, yeah.
Yeah. No, the archery tree turning into vats.
Nice. Slow down time, I think, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and David, why don't you round us out with Christopher Schley?
Christopher Schley says, as far as varied playstyles, one of my favorites is Arcanum of Steamworks and Magic Obscura. There were so many different characters that you could decide to play as, so much so that you had to be extremely specific with your build, lest you spread your stats, oh, so many things to put points into, too thin and not make it very far. As far as choices, I'd say Planescape Torment or Baldur's Gate 2. But I don't know, there are countless decisions to be made and choices to make, yet they all pretty much end the same way. They made things change in game at times, but not really the ending. But I'd take that. Seriously, all the ways to talk to Ravel, yeah. Is that correct?
No.
And take out the transcendent one in Torment, where joy to discover.
Yeah.
I suppose The Witcher would be another option that seemed to have some big choices that changed the story as you made those choices. And I think it had different endings as well. I can't remember. I only played it once. I really dug it, though. I should go back to it.
Yeah. Dennis and I were talking offline before you two joined us. The Witcher is a huge blind spot for us.
Yeah, it really is. It looks amazing.
Yeah.
I just like that this entire post is Chris gradually talking himself into playing it again.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah, okay, here's this. Maybe I should. Okay, I'm going to.
twist my arm. I'll go play it again.
Yeah, then it's just him typing all of his Steam billing information into the comment box. I deleted that for you, Chris. Just
Dad.
To be safe. You may Dad. Yeah.
I think clearly I've never played it, but clearly Arcanum of Steamworks and Magic Obscura, by the fact that Steamworks is in the name, means that it is one of the greatest games of all time.
Yeah, it means people can make mods for it.
Huh.
No, that's a super dumb joke. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Oh, Steve, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. That's what we call a way Homer.
Did you play you were into the Baldur's Gate and Planescape, right, Cole?
Yeah, I played a little bit of Baldur's Gate, but Planescape, we did it for WoW, and I really love that game. It is very good. It is a good game.
Mm-hmm.
No further questions?
Well, there you go.
Dennis's it means that the conversation is over, and we need to move to the new one.
And Dennis has spoken. Okay.
Now you see the strings.
Has anybody... You know the ticks. Has anybody not said their thing? I forget. Ben, you said yours, right?
Yeah.
You did.
David did Infamously. Yeah, we're through them all.
Oh, okay, cool. So if you would like to participate in those conversations in the future, like us on Facebook. It is facebook.com/TheLevelPodcast, where we put those out generally on Tuesday afternoons or evenings. Thank you, everybody, for responding both in force and so thoughtfully. It is time for The Grind, where we talk about the games we have been playing over the past week. Please note that Bioshock, nor Bioshock Infinite, nor Bioshock 2, nor Bioshock Burial at Sea are considered a fair game for this discussion.
Dang it.
We gotta save that. We can't burn cast, okay?
Yeah.
So who wants to lead? Go.
I can go first. Yeah. So what I've been grinding on is Skyrails, and so I can't talk about what I've been playing.
Oh, jeez.
But I will talk about it emphatically next week.
Oh.
So
seriously, nothing else?
Sorry, dude. Yeah.
It's okay. Sorry. I didn't. I so insensitively placed the moratorium. How do you like it? I mean, are you?
No, it's good. I've been taking notes. I finished Bioshock 1 like maybe a week or two ago. I don't think we didn't do anything last week, so I didn't get to talk about that, but that's okay. And so I started up Bioshock Infinite, and so I'm probably maybe a third of the way through, maybe.
Can you signpost the area of the trap?
I just fell.
Okay.
Yeah, that's so maybe neat. A little bit less than a third, but I don't know.
Cool.
There's a nice parallel so far. I won't go into detail, whatever.
Yeah.
Sorry. Oh, but we will.
Yeah, we will. Don't worry. Oh, we will. Huh. David, how about you? Because I get a sense that you're going to be in a similar boat, so let's get these disappointments out of the way.
Yeah, I've been doing a ton of Bioshock 1. I don't know. I guess I'll go with I've still been playing a lot of Fallen London. Kind of a highlight. I've been tracking down Fallen London has their equivalent of Jack the Ripper, which they call Jack of Smiles. His big thing, other than the fact that he's very angry because no one dies permanently in Fallen London, is that he apparently is able to transport between bodies so that there's, like, someone can become Jack the Ripper at any given time. And so I've basically been hired by the constables to track him down, and I've gone like most of the way through the story, and now I'm at an option where basically the option is either track down Jack the Ripper or become Jack the Ripper.
Okay.
Huh. So in terms of interesting story choice, I guess that could be one of them.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of a thing I'm doing. The other thing, I've been playing still a ton of WildStar. It still continues to be pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. I think I found a element of the gameplay that really encapsulates all that makes the game awesome, which is the fact that when you harvest plants for the cooking profession, you do so by shooting them.
Okay.
But it's okay because the game assures you that they had it coming.
Damn it, all I got was bullet root. I get that every time.
But, so far it's really good. I played through like the first main zone on, this kind of like on World of Warcraft, like was mentioned, the multiplayer, there's, you know, two main like paths through the game. I played through one of the main zones on my gunslinger, and now I'm playing the other one, which is the, nature lover, anime people, and the space zombie zone on my rogue class.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really enjoying it. It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of just like crazy stuff they make you do. I do find it funny that some of the... I'm playing as a good faction, but they definitely may give you some very morally ambiguous slash not moral missions.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, one of the missions I just got given, they've captured a whole bunch of one of the enemy factions and want you to test various weapons on them.
Huh.
So it's within story, you know, it works within the story because in particular the space zombie faction is written to be very much more kind of morally ambiguous, stuff like that, but it's an interesting way to play it.
Yeah.
So but no, it's a really, really great game. I guess that's all I have to say about that.
Mm. So our friend and yours, Zach, from the Video Games Hot Dog podcast, was talking about something weird about the economy. I want to get your take on,
sure.
Which is apparently you can use real money to buy game time, and game
yes.
time is something you can directly trade with people. So that
yeah.
is their kind of backdoor EVE Online esque way to kind of keep their economy tied to something real. What's your sense of that as somebody who kind of has more experience with MMOs than I think most of us?
Sure. EVE Online did pretty much the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for that, I mean, it seemed to work fairly well. And from what I got the understanding of is that at least in EVE, it eventually became a thing where, like, Any of the fairly dedicated players, kind of anyone that's kind of a core EVE player, generally speaking, does not pay real world money for their game time.
Right.
Which I feel like
they just trade a bunch of their real time for game time.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
I feel like I don't know from like a game development or like game economy standpoint what that has. I do find that interesting as sort of a way to do kind of a backdoor free to play for like their more dedicated players.
Hmm. I don't know that I ever want you to say backdoor free to play again.
Well, I don't know, like. I suppose it's a way to buy, to kind of effectively buy in-game currency. it seems like right now, it seems like the game actually has a fair amount of gold sinks. Mm-hmm. And a month of gameplay buys you a fair amount of gold. So I could see people actually wanting to do that. I don't know. I think it's interesting. I'll be interested to see how prevalent it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, at least they're trying to like ask and answer those questions early.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. It seems like to a large degree, this is in a lot of ways, the same way the original World of Warcraft was. It seems like this is a game that in a lot of ways is set up around like, here's a game where we basically did all the things right that everyone in the past, 10 years of MMOs knew they should have done right. Does that kind of make sense?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, they're asking questions that people failed to ask, and it bit them in the ass.
Right, yeah. And also just kind of, you know, all the things that, like, you always knew should be different, but weren't because, you know, the game was already out, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
They kind of took a blank slate and made all those decisions correctly the first time.
Yeah.
I would say going forward, my main concern on what I could see killing the game is they very much have a strong segment of being like hardcore friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the problem with that is like make a game difficult and challenging, I think is valid. But I feel like when you get into hardcore, that almost inevitably ends up into like Final Destination, no items territory.
Yeah.
So
you know what? Just don't bow to the assholes when you're making your game. Problem solved.
Yeah, I feel like I can understand what they're saying in terms of like there's definitely a degree to which a lot of MMOs and games in general are kind of getting like. I'm doing air quotes right now, but you cannot see, dumbed down for the casuals.
Yeah.
I can understand why they would want to fight against that. I feel like the problem is there's a reason why people do that, which is because like in the original World of Warcraft, it was basically if you don't poop sock, you can never play a raid. You know, boy, and there's a difference between say like Dark Souls, where it's like this game is really, really hard, but if you keep at it, you can eventually see the game on your own time, versus like if you're not willing to play in like 6 hour marathons, you can never do this. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's like there's no economy of scale for your time. It's not like after a certain amount of time, things become less effort. It's just a constant amount of effort that you always have to expend to get that same kind of, you know, payout or the payout that you're wanting to even get.
Right. And, yeah. And it's kind of funny because I would say by far the most difficult recent MMO would be Fallen London without question, much more difficult than even WildStar. Mm-hmm. And it's very casual friendly.
Yeah. Good. I like that.
So.
Up with the casuals. Yeah.
Unite!
Is that all you got, David?
Yes, it is.
Oh. So now it's down between you and me, Dennis.
Let's go.
I have two new ones.
I have two new ones as well.
Ah, damn it.
Let's alternate. Let's mix it up.
Oh,
Never before done in level history.
Oh, this is going to complicate my notes.
Ooh.
Okay. All right, so you go first. I'll try and find a way to deal with this later. Okay.
If it's seriously going to throw you off your game, we can do it regular.
No, it's fine. It's
cool that. Solution. If it's going to throw it off your game, we're definitely doing it.
Yeah, I'll just be over here rocking silently.
Look at it this way, Cole. You get to invent some new systems now.
Okay, cool.
Just buy some more index cards.
You know what? I am running low on that 1,000 I bought 2 months ago. So.
Just get one of those notebooks they make for shorthand where it's like two columns.
Oh, like a steno book? Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got those too. Field Notes, man, makes a great steno book.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so the big new game that I've been playing is called Surge Deluxe. And I'm putting a picture into the robot because I'm going to try to describe what it's like, but you kind of need to almost see it, sorry, listeners, to fully understand. It's a puzzle game, but it's not like any other puzzle game I've played. So most of the time when there's a puzzle game, it's really easy to go, oh, it's like a match three combined with some RPG elements, or, you know, it's like a Tetris, only there's only two colors, or, you know, something like that. Whereas Surge, I really don't know an easy analog for it. So basically, every level starts with tiles on two sides of the screen, stacked from the left and right side of the screen in, I think like about five deep. And there, you know, there are a bunch of different colors, and you play by kind of drawing on the Vita. You know, so it's all touch-based, and you just have to draw a connection between like-colored tiles. And the objective for the level is to clear all the tiles, which is not hard to do at all, because even if you kind of run out of light colored tiles, so let's say you only have one left, it'll drop in a new one for you. So it's not hard to clear the level in time, except on both the left and right side of your screen, there's a pressure gauge. And that pressure gauge is continuously going up, and what you need to do is kind of completely eliminate a row of tiles on the left side or the right side to kind of open up a valve for that pressure gauge. Follow me so far?
Yes.
Probably not at all, but anyway, so you're kind of both trying to clear all the tiles, and you know, the more of a light color you match together, the higher points you get, but you have to balance that with the need to race to get to the bottom of at least one of the rows, or I guess you define that as the side of one of the rows, so that you can open up the pressure gauges.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this really interesting kind of intersection of risk and reward, because what's going to get you the highest score is going to slow you down. But you know, if you completely play it safe, you're not really going to make a lot of points. And combine that with this kind of drawing on the screen, completely touch controlled interface, and you get into this flow where it feels like you're in Minority Report with like the computer interfaces and everything.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're not thinking about it too much anymore. You're just like do, you know, and swiping your finger all over the place. Yeah. And it just feels really good. So the game is really bright and, you know, conducive to that kind of flow state. And different than anything else I've seen before. So it's really cool.
Yeah, that sounds interesting, because what you're describing is the interface disappearing.
Yeah, exactly. And there are a couple missteps where, you know, it kind of brings you back down to reality. There's, you know, they have different special tiles, and one of them changes colors at certain intervals. Mm-hmm. And so that always, like, you know, you kind of start a chain just by picking whatever color you want and then, you know, drawing your finger around real quick to all like colors. But unless you're starting with that one that changes, you'll all too often, you know, end my chain because it's changed colors and I run my finger over it and that breaks the chain. And that's just annoying. Like, I get that they were trying to make you think a little more with that and say, okay, you're going to have to wait and start with this one, or, you know, wait for it to be the right color. But that's not what's fun about the game. What's fun about the game is feeling like you're manipulating a Minority Report computer.
Mm-hmm. When you start with it, does it stay that color, or do you have a limited amount of time to make the chain?
Yeah, when you start with it, it locks into that color.
Okay.
So, but that winds up into me, you know, kind of just sitting there for a couple seconds being like, okay, blue, orange, yellow, pink. Okay, there we go.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
I kind of like the idea you mentioned of where it's sort of easy to beat a level, but the real challenge is the score. It seems like not that many games do that. I remember, like, the only other game I really remember doing that, which is silly, is Yoshi's Story. Kind of had a similar thing.
Huh,
but sure. I feel like that's kind of a neat way to do things.
Yeah, well, it's adequate versus optimized. Like, you know, it's a separation between, you know, failure, winning, and succeeding, right? Yeah, failure is, you know, these two rows meet in the middle and you're done, or the pressure fills up. You know, winning is you clear everything. Succeeding is actually maximizing your score.
Exactly, yeah. And it's really funny how often I'll get so focused because it's like, oh, it's easy, you know, to keep the pressure gauges in check. I'll get so focused on optimizing that I forget about that simple basic thing I need to do and then get in huge trouble or wind up failing because I've just, my attention was drawn elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Which again, that speaks to me that this game has a really good balance to it of all those different objectives of succeeding versus just kind of passing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one of the things I've been playing.
Okay, cool. So I'll do a similar puzzle based one and say Haunch the House, Terror Town.
Hubba what?
Haunch the House, Terror Town.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is a game. It is on Steam. It was on sale it was a launch sale, so it was like $3 or something. It's regularly $5. And I figured, you know what, I can give $5 to something called Haunt the House, Terror Town.
It's yeah, you can.
Haunt the House, : Terror Town. it's pretty neat. It's a little scant. Just by a smidge. So the premise is, what if you took all of the visual novel aspects out of Ghost Trick, Phantom Detective?
Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah. So you are a ghost, and I gotta say, like the graphics on this are just the most fucking adorable thing. Everything is kind of like a storybook, like a vector storybook kind of thing. The animation is great. Like your ghost character is wearing like a frilly little collar. It looks amazing. But you control him either with your mouse, or I was doing it with an analog stick, and you press the A button to possess an object, and you have these four different locales, these four different houses that are that are occupied by people. And so, you know, say you possess a mirror, right? You can press a button to make it rattle, and you spook some people out, and you jump over to a candelabra, and you can like move that left and right, and people are like, oh no. And as you do things to freak people out, you you raise kind of the atmosphere gauge. Mm-hmm. Which is from like, hey, nothing's happening, all the way up to terrifying. So you're trying to like raise the ambient level of horror by freaking out as many people as possible. So picking out rooms where people are doing their thing and trying to do this. But as the atmosphere meter goes up, you get access to new little tricks that you can do. Tricks, for lack of a better word. So at that same mirror, instead of just rattling it, you can crack it. Or you can have like a spooky face show up and laugh, or you can have like, you know, something peek out from around the side, or on those candelabras, it can be like, oh, you can make the candles flare up, or, oh, the candles can spew black ooze. A bunch of stuff spews black ooze. As you press.
Truly nothing.
Good.
Truly nothing is more terrifying though than a mirror.
Oh, true. Yeah. But you know, so the game becomes, you know, like the goal is you're trying to, scare as many people out of the house as possible, or as you finish the level, you also find out, oh, you can just like straight up kill people, so you can kill as many people as possible in this. And it's like a super cutesy, like, it's not even like an Ed Gorey kind of thing where you're like, oh, this is sinister. It's like super cutesy. So the idea that, you know, there are some people that you have to kill because you can't scare them away, and the idea is you're trying to reclaim your family. So it's so it's a weird like reverse Casper the Friendly Ghost kind of situation. I'm talking about the movie version with was it Bill Pullman or Bill Paxton? Ah, you know what? Doesn't matter. that's the nominal story of it. But it becomes a bit of a puzzle game because everything is possessible, like except for people and except for like living animals. So they're like rats and stuff that are set dressing. Everything has either the ability to move or something that you can do. Like a verb set to, you know, free people out. And you can kind of create these chain reactions in a like Little Inferno light-esque fashion.
Huh.
Yeah. Mm. And so you have like these four places, and it's a real short game. I cleared it in like 20 minutes or so. But the idea is you're supposed to go through it again, knowing what you know now about the way things interact, and try and like maximize your score. So there's like a house, there's a museum, there's a hospital, and there's like a boat, like a yacht.
That's in dock. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought where you were going with the multiple houses thing, and here's a fun idea for the DLC, I guess, is like, you know, if you scared someone too much, like too fast, they would just move out of the house and go to a different house.
It was like Beetlejuice. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the idea is that you need to like continuously raise their level of terror without doing it so quickly that they left.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That'd be interesting.
Huh,
but so like these are actually just, this isn't like just multiple houses. These are completely different environs.
Right. Yeah, yeah, and you can go between them at will. You're just like this cute little ghost with red little cheeks and like like an Adventure Time face. Yeah, it's pretty neat. Like, you know, for it is an iOS ass experience. You know, that you're going to have on your computer. But that's okay, because the price is low, the time invested is minimal, and the imagery is fun, and it's nice to see how inventive they get with. You know what happens when you possess a dinosaur skeleton? Who knows? You know?
I think you can play Dark Souls 2 to find out.
Spoilers. I was going to say, wasn't that like Parasite Eve?
Yes, that was. Let us cite other dinosaur skeletons in popular media. I have no idea.
Night at the Museum?
Yeah, yeah, true. Huh.
Was Super Mario Bros. The skeleton? Was that skeleton turtles? Could those be considered skeleton dinosaurs?
You know, dry bones. Those were evil.
Yeah, the dry bones. So there was also dry Bowser. Yeah.
Huh. Kind of a dinosaur.
Yeah, life is weird. Dinosaur turtle. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. I kind of just bought it on a straight whim, and I was pleased. I was pleased by what I saw.
And it's got a great name.
Yeah, Haunt the House, Terror Town. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions about that, Ben?
Haunt the yacht.
Haunt the yacht. All right, so it's my turn now, right?
Yeah, it's your turn, I guess. I don't know.
Mixing it up.
You're making the new rules here, man. Fuck.
So
As Cole's nose starts to bleed.
Ben's head hurts. Cole's nose is bleeding. Maybe we're in Haunt the House, Terror Town. The other game I played, and this is just a quick one-off, is Pixel Junk Monsters, which is like a tower defense game. Pretty straightforward. The one thing that makes it notable is that, you know, I downloaded it just because I was like, oh, you know, I could use a little tower defense to kill 5 minutes here and there. But these things are long, involved levels. Yeah. Like one level you can play for 20 minutes and then fail at the very end and maybe throw your Vita. But like, I guess I never, you know, it is slog has such a negative connotation. So that's the wrong word to use for it. But the thing that surprised me is that hiding under a very cutesy veneer and pretty standard tower defense mechanics is, you know, really lengthy missions. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I've seen a tower defense game kind of play out on that time scale, like it does with Pixel Junk Monsters.
When you say missions, is this, you know, just something that's achieved by throwing different sequences of enemies at you, or are there actual goals that you're trying to accomplish?
No, the former is exactly it. So you are, everything is a forest, and there's kind of a path through the forest that the enemies will follow. And any one of the trees can be kind of replaced with a tower of different types. And so the other thing is that like the enemies move much more organically. And of course the trees are kind of much more organically placed. So it doesn't feel like you're on a grid. It feels much more free form than that. Whereas most tower defense shooters, everything kind of has a one by one grid that tells you exactly where things are placed in relation to exactly where the enemies are going to be.
Yeah.
So that's a little different. But yeah, I, at least at this point, I have not seen any sort of unique objectives beyond just make sure these waves of enemies don't get too many of your guys at the base.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that one's kind of a throwaway, but it is a thing I've been playing. Yeah. And if you want to get horribly, horribly frustrated, just play that for 20 minutes and then fail on the very last wave. Infuriating.
God, and they don't checkpoint at all?
No, you got to start the mission over.
Weird. So, like, this is the original Pixel Junk Monsters, right? This isn't, like, Monsters 2 or something?
No, this is the original.
Okay, yeah. So that's, like, one of the canonical tower defense games. This was back before that really got too terribly saturated. I wonder if it's kind of bizarre that they hadn't updated it to include some kind of checkpointing, because that's really hostile, because most tower defense games that I've played recently have had that as kind of a concession. Right.
Yeah. And so sorry, I didn't call that out. It is an older game. Yeah. And it definitely shows that, I think, in those specific ways.
Yeah. Huh. So unless there's anything more about that, I'll do mine and we can round out the night.
Let's do it.
Yeah. So Watch Dogs, guys.
Oh, shit.
Ooh.
Oh yeah. Hell. We got some time left in this episode then.
Scooping y'all. Yeah, so I've only done a little bit, so I've played according to my Uplay. God, I can't believe I can't get this fucking thing into Steam. Okay, so I started out by complaining about the way that I got it. So a listener gave this to me. In the interest of full disclosure, it's just a code that I received from a very kind person who wanted me to have it. So for that, I am very grateful. And I'm also grateful because it is a good game. I like it so far anyway. Good. Like, it's not terribly inspired. Like, the hacking might as well be magic. but as a big, dumb spectacle on par with what you would expect from an Assassin's Creed game, if you go into it with those expectations, you're going to be pleasantly surprised, because like, it does GTA-ass Assassin's Creed, which is pretty cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Those are two good things to combine.
Definitely. I mean, just the scope of the city, and also the improved control over it. Yeah, it plays kind of like a collision of a bunch of different properties. So I'll just kind of give impressions as I go, and we can comment on them. So it looks amazing. Like this is the test that I've been waiting for my gaming PC. Honestly.
Hmm.
Yeah, and I'm playing it maxed out, and it runs great. You know, like. I'm able to turn on VSync, so there's no tearing. Like, everything looks fine. Like, the animation could be better, I think. Like, some of the cutscenes, they don't do the lip sync quite right, and I feel like I'm spoiled by something that looks that good should also move in a way that is good to match it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, my gosh, like, the city. So I've only been to Chicago once. And that was when I was very young. I think I was like 4 years old, and it was just kind of like, let's take a plane to go see Chicago. Then we went to Chicago, and it was a fun trip. I don't remember too much about it. But being somebody who lives in a Midwest city, it feels like you're driving around in a Midwest city. Like, it kind of captures that weird, like, suburbs going into, you know, urban, going back into suburbs, going into urban blight, going into, like, it feels right, you know. And, you know, if Watch Dogs 2 continues the trend of being in non-standard video game cities and they leave Chicago or whatever, I could totally see it coming to Cincinnati.
So how far out does that, and first off, yes, who do we ask to do that? Second off, how far out can you get into the suburbs?
I have no idea.
Okay.
So I haven't tested the width of it, really, or the breadth. But you got some places that just kind of look like, oh yeah, this is like old, and you know, like old residential neighborhood that has a lot of grass, a lot of green space. Like, you know, like this is something that was here, and this is probably a very old community that is like peppered in next to, like, oh, here are a bunch of train tracks, and here are a bunch of, you know, like, you know, high rises, right?
Yeah, I would be super interested, because I have spent a lot of time in Chicago, and you know, it could probably identify different neighborhoods by how they looked depending on the neighborhood. But I've heard it's an incredibly faithful reproduction.
Yeah.
And so I'm very interested to see just kind of how deep they, or how true they were to the city, and what concessions they had to make in the name of gameplay.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think that it's not as, like, wide in scope as, like, a Grand Theft Auto 5, Ben. Mm-hmm. Like, where you go, you know, just, like, straight out into, like, oh, this is just desert, and there are, like, meth zombies everywhere. Like, it doesn't, you don't have that breadth of experience.
Wait,
I think.
Is that in Grand Theft Auto 5? Zombies?
I mean, meth zombies, you know.
Everything is in Grand Theft Auto 5. It's got more things than real life.
Yeah. But that kind of leads into this. Like, it feels pretty cool. Like, as you're going around, there's like this, I mean, it's part of the theme of the game, but there's this inundation of information, right? So, you know, God, Aiden, stop naming your people fucking Aiden names. It sucks. Yeah, but Aiden Pierce, he's always got a smartphone in his hand. So he's like everybody. You know, that overlays the information. So as you, you know, if you have the phone out and you mouse over people or you, you know, cursor over people, you get relevant information about them, which quickly gets really creepy because it's like, oh, this person is on several anti-anxiety drugs, or, oh, this person, you know, has this many criminal charges and this is how much money they make and stuff. And so that like highlights over people. But as you're passing by, you can spot crimes that are about to happen. You can spot, you know, different things that you could hack into. So as you're driving, you can, as is, I'm not saying anything that's really new, you know, there're not a whole lot of new insights in this, but, mm-hmm. you know, you can like hack the, you know, the traffic lights to stop people who are chasing you, right? You know, like, let's create, you know, traffic accident to, you know, to slow things down. You can, you know, move the bridges up and down. You can cause things to explode in people's paths. So like the world is very interactable. And so that is something that is, you know, distinct from Grand Theft Auto, where, you know, the driving is really fun and there's a lot to kind of see and look at. In Watch Dogs, even though the city is like kind of smaller and a little bit more compact, as you're going along, you can affect the world and, you know, in ways that serve you in really good ways. And again, you know, the tech is like magic. You might as well be walking around with a magic wand.
Right? Screw that. Tech really is magic.
Yeah.
I'm a wizard from the moon.
What was that game? I want to say it was Flat Out, but that's not it. It was a racing game where the whole shtick was that as you're driving around in the car, you could trigger events.
You're thinking of Split Second,
developed and
published by Disney, actually.
Yeah, I love that. Was actually a really, really good game.
It was a fun-ass game.
Yeah, it sounds like the driving in Watch Dogs kind of has flavors of that.
Yeah, a little bit.
Now, are you held karmically responsible for say like deaths if no one can tell you caused them? So like if you're always trying
to figure out ways to kill people in games without like facing any consequences for it.
Yes, in games.
Yeah. Wink wink. Yeah.
So I haven't noticed anything. Like, it's just a matter of like, oh, if you run up over a bunch of people on a sidewalk, your reputation is going to take a negative hit, right?
Okay, I just went like, for example, if you stop someone chasing you with by causing an accident, does that ding your karma?
As far as I know, no, but I haven't done it too terribly many times, so that may come back to bite you in a, you know, in a way. But yeah, but
your
right.
Car that, insurance that, is off the record.
That is inherently fucked up. That you're like you're going out there trying to avenge one death. That's the, you know, impetus for the story, and just as a matter of pressing the X button, you're able to, or you know, square or whatever, you're able to you know, just end tens of lives. In these horrible accidents.
Do they, yeah. When you mentioned the, you know, seeing crimes, you know, about to happen, is this like precog style, like Minority Report, or like kind of, or is there more of like a, is there like a detective-y element where you have to kind of put together that crime is about to happen?
So the fiction around it, it's a little bit precoggy, but like, so you get the sense. So let me compose this thought before I say it. You get the sense that somebody's, you know, criminal, or, you know, as you're walking around, everything is tied into, I forget what it's called, but it's like, it's being sold as the smart city, you know, where everything, yeah. It's the Internet of Things, right? Like, you know, this is a whole game that is about the evil of the Internet of Things. And, you know, so you're walking by and you get a flash like, oh, criminal activity in this area, something. And what it's looking at is this person talking on the phone or texting, and, you know, it's picking up like trigger words. So if they're texting, you actually see on your little readout what they're saying. And it's like, yeah, you know, you best be sure you're home, going to be shots fired, you know, et cetera and stuff. Like, it's looking for, like, you know, examples of people saying things that are, you know, that indicate there's going to be a crime, and then there, you know, it gives you a mission marker to go and check that out, and you basically wait for probable cause to take them out.
Interesting. So is there ever a situation in which the trigger words are wrong?
I haven't run into that just yet. You would think, which is why my strategy for taking everybody out has been to whip out a baton, which is your melee attack. It's not like a punch or whatever, because Aiden's just like, he's a nerd, right? He's a, you know, yeah, he's like IT, he's like an IT Merlin, right? Your melee attack is just to whip out a police baton that like telescopes and just like kneecap people.
Oh man,
it's the funniest thing ever.
Bop.
Yeah. The wathack. Yeah.
I just imagine like big Adam West Batman style like thwacks and pows jumping out while you're doing it.
Zazzle. Yeah.
I don't know, like, I feel like that would be a cool thing that I'd like to see there. That was one of the things I kind of liked about, was it Red Dead Redemption, where like you'd have these random events and you had to like snap decision figure out like who was the good guy, who was the bad guy.
Yeah, yeah. Being the sheriff, you know, you're running a town, right? Yeah. And you know, like there was one situation, this is all in the first 2.5 hours, so it's, you know, hardly spoiler territory, but there's a time when your sister gets this call saying like, hey, you know, you better lock your doors, I know that you have a son, he lives on the second floor, etc. Somebody's like menacing him, mm-hmm. or menacing both of them, and you know, you as the older brother, kind of your entire motivation is to protect, you know, her and, you know, basically your family, and so you go chasing him down by tracing his cell phone signal, and you know, you have to run him off the road, and I just like floor over him by accident, thinking like, okay, I'm just gonna whip out my baton and whathack him. I just like roll over him and roll back, and it's like, okay, I check his voicemail by hacking into his actual phone, and it's like, oh, he was just paid to make a prank phone call and he had no idea what he was doing. It's like, oh, well, shit. I feel terrible about this. Drives away slowly on a motorcycle. Yeah,
no, that's more like a brrr.
Yeah.
So what about, I've seen lots of kind of like funny or joke elements to the game where, like, you know, since you're seeing information on literally everyone, some of them are just intended to be funny. Mm-hmm. Have you seen anything like that?
There are a lot of them that are like game industry and joke kind of things. Okay. So it's like, oh, this person's a game tester. They make $12,000 a year. Or, you know, just like a lot of it is just like, what do they do versus how much money do they make?
Okay, gotcha.
You know, so it's there's a little bit of that that's funny, but like some of the miscellaneous text is like amateur fortune teller, or yeah, there's something that's kind of gross about it, which is like occasionally they pull up like, is transgender or is homosexual, as like information that person is trying to hide, like along like right alongside oh, this person, you know, killed 3 people and nobody knows about it except for the system. It's like, there's some weird equivalencies drawn there.
Yeah.
Like, probably not probably not like explicit, like, oh, we're trying to say, like, make this value judgment. But it's like, just maybe think of something else to put in there for that placeholder text.
Possibly. Although, could it potentially have been meant as social commentary in that it's kind of sick that this is something someone needs to hide?
You know what? That also is a valid judgment that I didn't think of. So, yeah. That could possibly be the case. It's not like, ew, they're a gross gay person. It's just like, is gay. It's like, okay, cool. And there are other like ones that are like harmless, which is, you know, like cheated on taxes, or, you know, some like, you know, white collar crime kind of things. And I can't imagine what went into actually populating that. You know,
I've seen one at least where it's like, it's someone's text conversation and they have like a typo where it's like, you know, I'm making lots of vaginas tonight. And they're like, oh, big night. And it's like, ah, shit, fajitas.
That's pretty good. So there was like one humorous exchange. So you can hack into people, and it's weird. This is the ghost trick hour, because, you know, some of the missions you can do, like if you have line of sight onto something, you can hack into it. And so a lot of the ways that you can get into these facilities and kind of like cause some chaos is to jump from camera to camera. And some people have like personal cameras on them, and you have to set up chains of like, okay, I will cause this distraction and, you know, jump into their personal camera so I can jump into the thing they're walking over next to. Right.
So the camera counts as, if the camera has line of sight, you're considered to have line of sight.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because really, computers are mesmerism.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, but you know, some of the things you can do in order to like create distractions is, you know, because everybody has their cell phone on them and nobody has a modicum of professionalism anymore. They are you know, you can text them and you know, engage them in a conversation. And this is pretty dark and, you know, trigger warning or whatever about you know, pretty gross things. But like there was one exchange that went like, dude, you told me they were 10, but like they've got to be 13 minimum. Like, oh, we're making child porn over here, kiddie porn over here. Like, I'm not at this number kind of thing. It's like, oh, you're kind of like just going full blast. And even though the subject matter is horrifying, it's like the shock value of it is there.
Huh. Yeah. So you're using this to like distract them and get them to like deny the conversation.
Exactly. So to basically to get them to go to a place where they're not going to be in your path anymore.
Huh.
Yeah. Which again is a neat premise, because you could just throw a rock, but why would you? Because everything is kind of again tied into this Internet of Things, right?
Yeah.
And everyone knows rocks have shitty network connections.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm trying to think of other things. The writing is almost universally very bad for the dialogue. Like, you know, you're not what I expected, and you're exactly what I estimated to be, or something like, oh God, stop. Like, it's worse than Matrix.
Is it like good, bad, the way, for example, the Matrix was, or just bad?
I get the sense that they're trying to be good and that they're trying to be like, okay, this is AAA game writing, which, you know, it can either be, you know, fun like Grand Theft Auto is, or take itself way too seriously. I get the sense that it's taking itself too seriously, sure. You know, which is a little bit of a shame. So you can put that layer of irony in between it and just like, okay, get me back to this next sequence where I can hop around like a camera magician. exactly, right?
Camera phantom.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, so does Nolan North do any voices?
Oh, I'm positive.
How do they generally structure your missions? Is it very linear to follow the story, or is it kind of like a Grand Theft Auto where, you know, icons pop up on your map and you can kind of go do whatever you want?
It's a little bit like a Grand Theft Auto. Like, there are things that can distract you on your way, and as you go, different things pop up. So there are the criminals, there are like little tailing missions that you can do as you go along, just kind of incidental missions. And in that way, it's a little bit like Assassin's Creed. In that the story, you know, like the story missions are kind of like linear in that sense, mm-hmm. except there are a lot of interesting distractions along the way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So do you kind of have the freedom to, in the middle of a main mission, kind of bail and go do this other thing, or kind of once you're in a main mission, is it kind of, maybe instance is the word for it, where you like go into a building and you're kind of in a sectioned off place?
I get the sense that that's the case. However, there is one instance very early on where you are going to start a mission and then somebody invades your world and you have go chase them down. So you think you're going to start a mission and then it pulls you into something entirely different.
Now that's supposed to happen like Dark Souls style throughout the game, right? Have you gotten any of that?
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
Nice.
And then it turns into like at least that particular flavor of it, where it's, you know, hacker versus hacker kind of things. You end up doing like an ad hoc version of Assassin's Creed multiplayer, where this person is trying to blend in and you have to seek them out with your with your little profiling machine.
What is the risk versus reward?
I don't know. Experience points. It's an Ubisoft game. There's just a bunch of numbers that go up. the risk is I may not catch this person. The reward is, oh, both of us are going to have a lot of fun with this, you know, psychosexual game of cat and mouse. So
nice.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. So the last thing, and I'm probably going to dip into this on and off. I still like just playing. It makes me want to go beat Grand Theft Auto 5 though, because I have not done that. I know, right? Like I feel like I'm remiss in that, which is vehicle stealth.
Hmm.
Yeah. So it
is
was
the name of the game.
No. It's a mechanic. So I mean, there are stealth elements as you're kind of going around doing this hacking stuff, but they kind of handle it in a pretty cool way. It's kind of frustrating when you first encounter it if you don't know what to expect. Like I failed the mission a bunch before I figured it out. But there's a mission that puts you in a place where you have to get off of kind of one of the islands of Chicago. And like it's under police lockdown, right? And all the police, as they're going around searching for you, have alert meters. And you have the ability to cut the engine and duck down in the car. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So as you're going along, if you see the alert meter going up, you kill the engine and you find a place where you can park that is non-conspicuous, and you kill the engine and slink down and hope that they pass by.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so that becomes a really tense way, because there are also like police helicopters, and there are also like roadblocks and stuff. So it's a matter of finding the right path through the alleyways. And hoping that you're not conspicuous. So if you're just a car that's like parked cattywampus across the middle of an alley, or you're knocking over a bunch of stuff, the police will come and investigate you, regardless of whether or not your engine is killed. But yeah, it's like a little stealth sequence, and I'd never seen that done in vehicles before. So even if it's not like entirely successful in terms of, you know, being fun or being immediately apparent how you succeed at it, it is a novel idea and a novel implementation.
So you can't just ghost ride the car and be like, oh, I'm a car that drives itself.
it's got a robot car, one of those American robot cars.
Dance outside the car and the police just drive right by.
Yeah, you dance outside the car like no one's watching.
Are there advantages to being in the car versus being on foot? Because I would imagine it's equally as easy to kind of hide behind a trash can as it is to park a car.
This mission forces you into that, because it's like a taxi mission almost. Like somebody hires you to do a driving thing, and this person is gut shot in the back seat. And
that does complicate things.
Yes, it does. So you're trying to go. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I don't imagine being too invested in the story unless it takes a really cool turn. But you know, a video game story in a game like this really just has to give me interesting things to do and a decent enough motivation to see what the next interesting thing is, and I'll be fine. So I don't understand what the backlash is at this point. Like, a lot of people are kind of like taking shits on it, and you know, maybe. You know, I kind of led into this saying, oh, it's like a big, dumb action game spectacle. Like, will my computer run this and how nice will it look kind of thing? Yeah. With that expectation, you know, and, you know, if that is enough for you, taking it on its terms and also recognizing I didn't pay money for this. All those caveats aside, it is pretty cool, and it is doing some things, and it shows a great deal of care, which is neat.
Very cool.
Yeah. Any other questions about that?
Can you swap people?
I mean, with your baton?
No, like, as in call the cops on, like, random people and have the SWAT kick their door down.
I don't know. Maybe. Want to button it up, Ben?
Yeah.
Pathetic.
No room for, like, I kind of want to play Watch Dogs, though.
Yeah, it seems like it'd be up your alley. The Assassin's Creedness aside, I think there's just enough GTA in it to give you enough to do.
I see.
Yeah, I mean, just based on the caricature of your taste that we have there. So, oh man, so what are we looking at here? What are we looking at? Thank you everybody for listening. This has been episode number 66 of The Level. Title incoming, I guess. What can you do? Well, first and foremost, if you are going to be buying anything off of Amazon, go to duckfeed.tv/tipjar and use that Amazon link. That is a great way to support the network without giving us money directly. If you would like to give money directly, you can go right to that same page and click on the link to the Patreon. You can get this out. You can get all of our episodes a day early. Across the entire network by donating to that at a certain level. People have come out in force. I'm staggered by the amount of support that is on there. And yeah, it's pretty cool. Other than that, specifically for this show, you can check out facebook.com/thelevelpodcast, where you can participate in the discussion. You can either comment in the post that's going to go up there, or you can you know, write in an email at duckfeed.tv/contact. For the senior producer on Bioshock Infinite for our bonus levels about that particular game. And, guys, am I missing anything?
I don't think so. Let's blow it up for our Bioshock Infinite interview.
Yeah, let's do it.
We'd love for you guys to come out in force and give us lots of questions to ask. Yeah.
You guys rule. Yeah. So yeah, let's call this one tonight. It is very late, and I am ready for bed. So I have been and continue to be Cole Ross. I am at Cole Ross on Twitter.
I am Dennis Furia at D Furia on Twitter.
I have been, but I'm not sure about continuing to be David Moneysmith, and I'm at Moneysmith777 on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ben Merkel at Merkelizer.
Yeah, and until next time, we got two rules for you. Pistols and talking.
Yes. Duck feed standard.
Boom. Yeah. Oh, guys, this is a small aside. I don't know if it's going to be post roll or not, but I didn't want to talk about Rocksmith on the show. So,
oh shit.
Yeah. So this can be our Rocksmith aside, and I may or may not insert it. I have no idea. But yeah. So
sounds like a Shakespearean intertext.
Rocksmith episode.
Yeah. So I got my new guitar for that, and it sounds pretty good. And Ben, specifically to your interests, because I'm following my Ben sense, they've got a Spoon song and a Minus the Bear song on there, which I am slowly working my way through. So it's me and the Bean and Cold Company. And the thing I'm learning about Minus the Bear, a lot of tapping, and I don't have any calluses on my right hand. So
I imagine Cold Company is one of their newer songs, because I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah.
But as Spoon goes, they're playing in Vegas in like a week, I Ooh. Think. So I might check Ooh. Them out.
Nice. Yeah, that's cool.
They're cool.
Yeah.
So, Cole, I meant to talk about this and then just forgot, but it's just as well. Because we've talked about Rocksmith for the past like 18 weeks in a row. but my dad randomly gave me a really nice acoustic electric guitar.
Ooh.
Which allowed me to kind of engage Rocksmith on that level.
Yeah.
Of kind of regular guitar. Mm-hmm. And so I know you had said in an episode past, like, you can't really speak to it as someone who's coming to it as a complete novice. You can only speak to it as someone who has, you know, at least some experience and is kind of picking it up to advance. So I can speak as a complete novice, at least on the regular guitar front. Mm-hmm. And it is infuriating.
What do you mean?
Sad to say. I think it what I'm really, really craving, because I try to use the riff repeater a lot to learn different sections, and to some extent it works. But what I really need is a riff repeater mode where when it gets to a note, it just kind of stops and waits for you to play it.
Oh yeah.
And then advances to the next note and stops and waits for you to play it. Specifically with chords, because it only shows the fingering on chords right as it's about to hit.
Yeah.
So it'll show you where to be on the frets, but it doesn't specifically say what you should be doing with each finger until right before it hits.
Yeah.
And I don't have the reflexes yet to be able to create that in the split second, and I don't have the experience yet to know it off the top of my head, like, oh, that's an E major, I do this, or that's a F minor, I do this.
And you don't find that the difficulty creep is getting you up to the point where, like, oh, I have one note in this, and then I make the power chord, then I make the three-string power chord, and then I've got the full one. Because that's been my experience, but then again, I came into this knowing most chords.
That's very different than what I've experienced, and maybe it's because I started on the bass guitar and got my difficulty, quote-unquote, up fairly high.
That's weird.
Like, I think it was like, oh, you're really good at bass guitar, so we mm-hmm. can start you harder. Because it started me out on rhythm guitar with, like, the full chords.
Oh, you shouldn't be doing rhythm.
Oh, no?
No, don't do
okay.
that.
Okay.
So pick lead if you're familiar with bass, because uh-huh. you know your way around the neck for that. Like,
yeah.
its way of teaching you chords is really bad,
okay.
at least
yeah,
in terms of what I've seen. You'll get enough chords in lead that you'll be able to get it.
Okay.
But and I would recommend practicing chords on your own outside of the game.
That's kind of what I've been doing. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
I was going to ask for your recommendation. Like, am I doing it wrong being in rhythm?
Yeah.
That's like, I mean, I know just for general getting what's different about a regular guitar that I need to learn.
Yeah.
Chords is it. Mm-hmm. So that's where I started. But okay, I'll go to lead
yeah.
then.
And yeah, definitely. So yeah, go to lead.
It'll
throw enough chords at you, and you'll be more comfortable with navigating around the neck for that. practice chords on your own, and if it is bumping up, it's weird that they don't have per path difficulty for that. But if you're feeling like, yeah, this song is just way too like a little bit too much English for me, mm-hmm. go in and do the riff repeater, select everything, and bump the whole difficulty down, and then exit and resume the song. That will set the difficulty to whatever you want it to be. So yeah, if it's like
smart,
yeah, if it's like rocking you straight at like 80-100% on a song because you got good at it on bass, go mm-hmm. in and ratchet it down manually, and you'll be able to do the climb back up, and that'll be a much more gentle curve.
Okay, that makes a ton of sense. Yeah, and then the only other comment I had on it, again, extra sewed material or whatever. Is that with guitar, I think you're much more learning phrases for a song, and it does not, you know, differentiate as much as with a bass, where it's all about, you know, the fills. And it's like almost at the end of every single bar, there's a unique fill for it.
Yeah.
And I found that's a little bit more difficult as you go to the master mode where it takes away the notes, because I have trouble, having learned it by sight, remembering exactly what fill goes where. And if you play the wrong fill on the wrong bar, it'll dock you for it.
Yeah.
Which again, it, you know, at some point it stops mattering. It's just like, play a fill. That's mm-hmm. what you need to do.
Yeah. Play something that sounds good to you.
Yeah, exactly. But that was just one other minor annoyance. But mm-hmm. overall, I'm still spending a ton of time with it.
Yeah. I mean, so, most people bounce off guitar like in the first week. So
yeah. Well, I've managed to cross that threshold.
Yeah.
So do you, I'm curious, you said you're having some difficulty. Do you feel that, you know, if this was like your sole thing to learn, could you do it?
Yeah. I mean, so like the big thing I've picked up is kind of what a major chord shape looks like and feels like for my hand. Like there's kind of just a shape you can make that then any point on the fret will form a major chord. Mm-hmm. But it didn't teach me that. I kind of just picked up like, oh, hey, all these chords kind of have the same shape. Yeah. And so I wonder if I make that shape and then without the game practice going up and down the neck and making that shape, I'm kind of starting to get the feel for it.
Yeah.
And you can again, do
like,
kind of,
like all the chords in a key going up and down, like specifically with bar chords. If you do that, you're going to be miles ahead of a lot of people, you know?
Yeah. So that's kind of where I'm slowly meandering. Not to extend a whole bunch of conversation on the game that we've done a lot, but I thought it would be interesting to bring the novice perspective to it.
Yeah, no, I was curious because I saw you tweet that, and I wasn't sure if you were serious or not.
Oh no, it's really kind of funny. My dad was like, "Hey, so are you still thinking about, you know, getting a regular guitar at some point?" And I was just like, "You know, I thought about it, but I don't think I need to invest in another guitar because, you know, I'm going to be losing a lot of free time anyway, and I just don't need another hobby in my life. So probably not." And he's like, "Well, I've got a free one that's like really nice that I'm not going to use." And I was like, yeah. Okay. I want to learn guitar. But he, I guess, you know, found this super rare guitar. There were like only 90 of them made in the world, and just happened to find like the one guy who owned it and didn't know what it was.
Oh,
and
yeah.
bought it from him for a song. And so he's got, you know, it's like, I forget the name of the guitar, but the style is like a low neck or whatever. So it's much easier to get up and play the really high frets.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's like super rare, and he found it for super cheap. And so his current guitar that he had, he's given away, which is still like a freaking $500 guitar. So yeah. I was happy to take it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Huh. But I have way more guitar than I have talent right now.
Yeah, well, you can grow into guitar.
That's like something to build to, yeah.
Yeah.
What are the chances if I mix vodka and Orange Crush that I end up with a screwdriver?
That's called an electric screwdriver.
Is that really a thing, or do you do that off the cuff?
Off the cuff.
Damn, that's good. I like that.
Come on, man. no, you what you got to do? You got to take vodka and Stewart's orange cream soda. You know what that is? It's a creamsicle.
Nice.
Yeah. Tastes delicious.
An alcoholic creamsicle.
And if you don't mind going into a store and buying a bottle of vanilla vodka, you can do a vanilla infused or vanilla flavored vodka and root beer, and it is a delicious root beer float flavored beverage.
Nice.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah, and you take some Dr. Pepper and you heat it up, and you mix in a little bit of gin with some bitters, and
you make meth,
and then you exactly.